would turn several cities into radioactive craters, despite the fact there was little evidence the cities were anything more than hospices for the dying variants. Beckham looked at another set of doors that led to the banquet room where he had married Kate 8 years ago. His worries dissolved at the happy memories from that night when they were surrounded by so many friends and family members. But he also thought of the friends and family members that hadn't survived to see their union. He pictured the faces of Captain Rachel Davis, all of the lost souls from Team Ghost, Firefighter Meg Pratt, Sergeant Jose Garcia, Lieutenant Colonel Ray Jensen, and so many others. No matter how many times he thought of his brothers and sisters, their faces and voices continued to fade away. His mind, like his ailing vision, was another wound from the war. It didn't help that he and Horn weren't the young men they'd been when they were fighting on Team Ghost. Beckham was 42, and Horn was pushing 40. Another door opened across the hallway, and Beckham glimpsed President Ringgold in the briefing room. She had also aged since Beckham had last seen her. That was just 6 months ago. She was under extreme stress trying to keep the country together and ensure her legacy continued with the election of Vice President Dan Lemke. The retired admiral was the best hope, in Beckham's opinion, for a bright future, a future he was here to discuss today. She shook hands with S.M. Fisher. The oil tycoon left the office, putting his cowboy hat on as he entered the lobby. He walked over to Beckham and Horn with two of his bodyguards flanking him.
"Captain Beckham?"
Fisher asked in a southern drawl that matched Horn's. Horn stepped up with his arms crossing his swollen chest and his chin up.
"Yeah," Beckham replied.
Fisher held out a hand.
"S.M. Fisher, pleased to meet you."
"I figured that's who you are," Beckham said, shaking his hand.
"Ah, I'm honored to hear that," Fisher said.
He glanced at Horn.
"And who is your friend?"
"Master Sergeant Parker Horn," Horn said, keeping his arms folded over his chest.
He finally reached out when Fisher extended his hand.
"Are you boys here to meet with Ringgold?"
Fisher asked.
"We're here to meet with the President of the Allied States," Beckham replied.
Beckham waited for Fisher to give him the reason for coming over to say hello. Less talking and more listening was the best strategy he had picked up over the years when he wasn't sure if he could trust someone.
"She's an impressive woman," Fisher said. "I'm grateful for the military support she has lent my growing oil operation. They have been helpful in dealing with the variants terrorizing my fields in Texas. But I'm hoping for more to eradicate this threat once and for all."
Beckham nodded.
"I'm told I can expect even more support from Vice President Lemke," Fisher said.
"He's a man of his word," Beckham replied.
"Glad to hear that. I'm curious to hear what General Cornelius has to say about the diseased bastards, though," Fisher said. "What do you boys think of him?"
"I think he would destroy your fields in the process," Horn said.
Fisher stroked his thick mustache.
"What my friend here means is the retired general's strategies might lean more on the reckless side of things," Beckham said. "You might get rid of your pests, but the collateral damage your fields would experience might not be worth it."
Fisher lowered his hand.
"He's a good man and served his country during the war. We just see things differently on how to keep the country moving forward," Beckham said.
"I see," Fisher said.
He seemed to think on it a moment and then nodded.
"I better get going. But it was nice to meet you two fellas.
Safe travels."
Beckham watched Fisher and his bodyguards leave in silence, but Big Horn didn't hold back his thoughts.
"I don't like that guy," Horn mumbled.
"The Vice President needs his endorsement. Fisher's company supplies nearly half of the country's oil, and he's got the wealth to fund a campaign all on his own. Like him or not, we want him on our side."
"Don't mean I have to like him, though," Horn said.
"That's true, but you could be more polite."
The lobby slowly emptied as the men continued to wait.
"Can we go to the bar for a beer or something?" Horn groaned.
"Shouldn't be too—"
A door creaked open, and Elizabeth Cortez walked into the lobby.
"Captain Beckham and Master Sergeant Horn," she said. "Thank you for making the journey."
She reached out, and Beckham shook her hand.
"If you'd follow me, please." They entered the Oval Office, where coffee and water had been set out on the tables, but the chairs were empty. POTUS and V-POTUS were not here. Elizabeth walked over to one of the side doors. Opening it, she then gestured inside to a long hallway. At the entrance beyond, two Marines stood like statues. Horn flung Beckham a glance, but neither of them said a word as they continued down the passage. Another pair of Marines stood guard in front of the closed doors of an elevator. Elizabeth typed a code onto a keypad and the doors whispered open. Beckham almost hesitated as a memory surfaced in his mind. This was the place Captain Rachel Davis and a small team of Navy SEALs had come to rescue former Vice President George Johnson. They had arrived too late, and the entire Presidential Emergency Operations Center, PEOC, was filled with the infected, including Johnson. The elevator took them deep underground, and Beckham tried to relax. When the doors opened again, a room bustling with activity greeted them. Military officers and civilian staffers worked at stations facing a wall-mounted monitor the size of a movie theater screen. It was split into multiple boxes filled with data and live video imagery. Elizabeth crossed the room to another door. She knocked, then peeked her head in.
"Good afternoon, Madam President," she said. "We have Captain Beckham and Master Sergeant Horn here to see you."
Elizabeth opened the door the rest of the way, gesturing inside.
"Thank you," Beckham said.
The door closed behind them, leaving the two retired Delta Force operators alone with the President and Vice President.
"Great to see you, Captain Beckham and Master Sergeant Horn," Ringgold said. "I'm very sorry to keep you both waiting."
She walked around the table. Beckham held out a hand for a shake, but Ringgold went past it, going in for a hug.
"How are your families?" she asked.
"Good, Madam President," Beckham began to say.
"Jan," Ringgold corrected. "I'm only going to be president a few more months, and I'm starting to train my friends to use my name."
"Ma'am," Beckham said with a dip of his head.
She smiled and shook Horn's hand.
"Everything's good at Peaks Island?" she asked.
"Very good, ma'am," Horn replied.
The Vice President had followed behind Ringgold and now stood waiting to shake their hands before taking a seat.
"I called you here in hopes that you would consider running for Senate against McComb. We need your voice and support in the chambers to help Lemke," Ringgold said.
"McComb is weak, and I'm worried he might defect to the Freedom Party," Lemke chimed in.
Horn said something under his breath that rhymed with hit, but Beckham ignored him.
"I'm honored, ma'am. But at this time, Kate and I would really like to stay out of politics," Beckham said. "I'm happy to help in other ways, of course, advising and maybe even a little campaigning for the party, but
I understand," Ringgold said. "It's something to think about, although it's not the only reason I brought you in. There are matters that will affect the election more than a Senate race."
"Lay it on us, Madam President," Horn said.
She looked to Lemke. Beckham braced to hear what had them both looking so fatigued and worried.
"There was an attack last night on Outpost Turkey River," Lemke said. "The radio SOS we received said variants had penetrated the outpost. We lost communications within minutes."
"What?"
Horn said, stepping forward.
"We sent a drone a few hours ago, and this is what was sent back," Ringgold said.
Lemke used a remote to click on the monitor across the table. Beckham stiffened in his chair and leaned forward to get a better view of the imagery on screen. With his poor vision in his right eye, he was having a hard time making out the grainy footage at first, but there was no mistaking the empty streets.
"Where is everyone?" Horn asked.
"That's what we're trying to figure out," Lemke said. "The drone did not find a single body of a human, or variant for that matter." "Did you ever come across anything like this during your time leading Team Ghost?" Ringgold asked Beckham.
His gaze flitted from the screen to meet hers.
"Not quite on this level, ma'am."
"There were nearly 300 people living at the outpost," Lemke said. "Gone, with barely a trace. They're one of the most important agricultural communities we have, too, and they had just recently started to harvest," Ringgold said. "We need this community, and we need to know what happened to them."
"At this point, we've only sent in the drone, but we're going to deploy a couple of teams to investigate," Lemke said. "We've got SEALs on deck already prepared to go, and then if that fails, we can bring in our experts."
Beckham knew what that meant.
Team Ghost was going back out there. He thought of Fitz, who had spent the past 10 years fighting the monsters during the war and post-war. The team had lost more souls since. Somehow, Fitz and Rico had survived all of the operations, but Beckham feared one of these days he would get a call that Fitz had finally run out of luck.
"I'd like you two to stick around an extra day to monitor the mission," Ringgold said. "We could use your input as this unfolds."
Beckham had promised Kate he would be back by the next morning, but she would understand.
"Absolutely," he said. "We're happy to help."
Ringgold stood and approached the screen, looking at the grainy footage.
"I'm worried there is something more sinister going on out there."
Lemke nodded.
"Me too.
And when word gets out about Turkey River going dark, it's going to fuel the support for Cornelius and his plan to ravage abandoned cities with bombs and a fresh army of young men and women."
"Not Matasha," Horn muttered.
Ringgold rotated from the screen, wearing a mask of concern.
"I know you two have already sacrificed so much, but I'm afraid we're going to need your help again to fight this new threat."
A chill passed through Beckham at the thought, and while he knew this didn't necessarily mean he would need to return to the battlefield, it did mean his days living in peace on the island were numbered.
4.
The screams of agony seemed to ricochet off the trees. Dohai tried to hone in on the direction, but the echo made identifying the location of its source in the treacherous terrain difficult. Another strong gust whipped through the foliage. Leaves swirled around him and the rest of Team Ghost, who had spread out in combat intervals. Dohai led the way into the thick forest. He cradled his suppressed M4A1, searching for targets. The screams suddenly stopped. He slowed, stepping on a dead leaf that crunched in the silence. For a moment he stood there, listening to the woods and the rush of the river not far behind them. He sniffed the autumn air, but picked up no sour scent from the variants. When the wind picked up again, he knew why.
"Christ," Dohai whispered to Fitz. "I think we're upwind from those screams."
"So the variants smelled us first,"
Ace grumbled quietly.
"That's why they silenced the prisoner," Dohai said. "They know we're hunting them."
"Then they'll start hunting us now, too,"
Lincoln said.
"The hunters just became the hunted,"
Dohai thought dourly.
"Find us that trail, Dohai," Fitz said. "Keep an eye out for camouflage beasts, too. It may be light out, but they'll still blend in."
Dohai nodded, not showing his frustration. People normally thought he had some mystical power that allowed him to listen and talk with the woods when he was tracking. That was nothing more than a stereotypical myth. Truth was, he'd learned not how to listen or talk to the woods, but how to read them. All the minuscule signs that led to your quarry were there if you put in the work. The forest didn't willingly give those signs up. You had to find them. He crouched to look for any clues. The ground was covered in leaves, making it exceedingly difficult to search for the footprints. Most people made the mistake of trying to track a person or variant down by looking at things from a single perspective, their own. They walked, standing straight, and kept their eyes ahead of them. Not very helpful when you were dealing with monsters that could climb, burrow, and even fly, as some across the Atlantic had once done. An open mind was the best way to come at problems like this. He raked his hands through the leaves, revealing the dried brown grass and patches of dirt underneath them. It would take hours to sift through the leaves if his goal was to find those variant footprints. But that wasn't his goal. Instead, he pressed his fingers against the soil. It gave easily. Not unlike the soil around downtown Ellicott City, where the floodwaters had softened and eroded it. The rain would have been strong enough to wash the hillside of the blood and little bits of flesh Dohai wanted to look for. But the waters hadn't washed away. The leaves hid. The weather was conspiring with the variants against him. A branch cracked somewhere in the distance. Mendez swiveled on his heels. Fitz motioned for everyone to keep still. Then he nodded at Dohai, who again took point. Team Ghost followed, walking at a hunch, their rifles roving for targets. Rifle pointing ahead, Dohai's eyes scanned the surroundings as he sought another sign, another hint of where the variant's trail had gone. He found it on the knotted brown bark of an oak. One of the gray-brown scales had been torn off to reveal a lighter patch of yellow wood no bigger than his thumb.
obvious to him, but maybe not to someone who wasn't looking. He plucked something from the bark that turned out to be a chunk of fingernail. Human from the looks of it. Dohai motioned them forward, spotting other tree trunks with scratches on them along with saplings that had been split. The casual wear on the landscape revealed the Alpha's preferred travel route. He could practically see a path now. He pushed forward through the foliage, advancing along the trail at a brisk pace. This wasn't the first time they had been on a mission to save civilians kidnapped by variants, and it likely wouldn't be their last. Most of their recent missions had ended with dead variants, but in most cases they were too late to save their prisoners. The loss of innocent lives weighed heavy on his mind like a dark storm cloud. He broke into a run, heart pounding. The scratches on the tree trunks and the depressed leaves and splintered twigs led the team. Around the next oak, a scent hit his nostrils. Dohai slowed his pace and motioned for Team Ghost to spread out again. Through the screen of trees, he spotted a gray dome propped up by four Doric pillars about twice as tall as a man, each covered by moss. A rusted iron cross was suspended from the dome, giving the structure the appearance of some kind of altar. Bricks lay around it, and huge gray slabs rested on the forest floor where the wind had brushed aside some of the leaves. The structure was some sort of a rotted chapel. The more Dohai looked between the trees and fallen logs, the more ruined structures he noticed. Most were barely more than a leftover foundation, while others had the remnants of brick walls suffocated by vegetation. Dohai held his breath to listen. A screech exploded through the trees. His stomach sank when he realized Team Ghost wasn't the only one studying the area. He swiveled toward the source of the sound, but Fitz found the camouflage target first. He fired short bursts. Bullets chiseled into one of the low-lying brick walls as a shape flung itself down for cover. Other inhuman shrieks blasted through the forest.
"Eyes up!" Fitz yelled.
Dohai raised his rifle at a hulking figure in the tree branches. Pangs of sunlight piercing through the leafy cover illuminated a creature with throbbing lips and needle-like teeth. Blood vessels pulsed under the mottled green and brown flesh perfectly matching the colors of its surroundings. Cover blown, it leapt from branch to branch, staying just ahead of Dohai's aim. When he finally had a shot, it suddenly changed directions. Dohai fired calculated bursts at the muscled beast and finally hit the target. Blood and flesh flicked out of the exit wounds. Mindful of his ammo, he fired one last burst as the creature sailed through the air. He jumped out of the way at the last minute, and the variant walloped the ground next to him, limp and dead on impact. Another camouflaged creature raced from behind one of the crumbled walls. Ragged black hair twisted in a knot behind its head. It drew back its claws, ready to use them as scythes. A flurry of rounds cut into the abomination as it made a run for Dohai, spraying hot blood over his fatigues.
"I got you, bro,"
Lincoln called out.
"Thanks,"
Dohai replied. The rattle of gunfire echoed around him as he moved to find a new target. His world became the view through his rifle's optics. Find a variant. Fire. Repeat. Surging adrenaline seemed to slow time as he sighted up each shot. Team Ghost had recovered quickly from their ambush. Ace's shotgun boomed as it decimated the bodies of beasts that had gotten too close. Mendez picked off the variants still swinging down from the trees, the sunlight hitting their camouflage skin. Fitz and Rico fended off the monsters further away, winding through the ruins with their suppressed shots. A final boom from Ace's shotgun announced the death of the last variant. The labored breaths of Team Ghost once again claimed the day. The only other sound was the moan of a dying beast that Fitz finished off with a double tap.
"Think that's the whole nest?" Rico asked.
"No," Dohai said. He picked up the muscled arm of one of the dead variants. The beast was strong, but it wasn't alpha strong. And the way they'd thrown themselves at Team Ghost likely meant they were cannon fodder, not the leader of this pack.
"Alpha's probably watching us now," Lincoln said, "trying to figure out who the weakest link is."
He shot a glance at Mendez, who spat on the ground.
"Then he'd be looking at you, hombre," retorted Mendez.
Dohai ignored them and searched for tracks. After a few minutes of looking, he located another trail. He motioned the team up chipped concrete stairs. At the bottom of the stairs, dark shapes flitted through the shadowy woods. Two appeared to be normal variants, loping after another. The third.
"There's the Alpha," Dohai said.
Fitz balled his hand.
"Hold your fire. It's got a hostage."
The beast was a good 3 feet taller than the others, and slender, with ropey muscles. The long limbs appeared insectile, both of them wrapped around a male human prisoner. Mottled patches of gray and black covered the camouflaged flesh. It turned and bolted with the man. The other two beasts screeched as they followed. Fitz gave the advance signal. Dohai had already taken off, fearing that if they lost it now, it would melt into the forest. It was no wonder the creature had been able to infiltrate Outpost Patapsco Valley so easily. The entire outpost was located in woods just like this. Dohai made up lost ground fast and brought his rifle to aim at one of those slender legs. The first shot found a target, ripping through a muscular calf. The alpha let out a roar and slammed into the ground, the hostage rolling away into the leaves. He kept his rifle shouldered, an eye on the other two variants that had slowed. The alpha pushed itself back up and hissed, brown saliva spraying Dohai as he approached and fired into the alpha's side. Despite the rounds, the creature barreled into Dohai, knocking him to the ground. He lost his rifle and went for his hatchet, pulling it from the sheath just as the alpha swiped his vest with jagged claws. Dohai planted the blade into its arm, yanked it out, and then struck it in the chin with a crunch. In his periphery, he saw Fitz engage with the other two variants, firing at them as they parried their claws with his rifle. Rico soon joined him. They formed a wall between themselves and the person that the variants had been carrying. The alpha let out another roar that nearly deafened Dohai as he tried to pry the blade free from its chin. It brought its fists down, hammering at his chest, and then climbed on top of him. Suddenly, blood sprayed from the alpha's mouth. The creature screeched in agony as nerves and muscles and bones gave way to Ace's machete. He hacked at the creature over and over until it finally succumbed to the injuries and died on top of Dohai. Ace helped push the beast off him and then offered his hand. Dohai took it and rose to his feet, thanking Ace with a nod and a clap on the heavy-set man's shoulder. The other two variants lay dead next to trees. Lincoln and Rico were already fanning out to hold sentry while Ace bent down to the survivor. The man crawled away on all fours.
"Relax, buddy," Ace said.
Mendez moved over to help. The man struggled as they peeled off the dried mucus plugs covering his mouth. He sobbed and scooted away on arms covered in bleeding wounds.
They killed the others. I saw them. Oh, God, you've got to help me. Help me.
Take it easy, Dohai said. We're going to get you out of here. Fitz pulled out his radio to reach command and walked over to Rico and Lincoln.
Help. Help.
The injured man kept repeating through quivering lips.
You're safe now, Mendez said.
He and Dohai worked on dressing the wounds. The man was clearly in shock. Fitz returned a moment later with a sour look.
I guess we're not going to have a celebratory beer tonight, huh? Lincoln said.
Not tonight, Fitz replied.
Please don't tell us all it takes is all you got, Mendez said. I really, really need a hot shower and to hit the rack.
Yeah, bro, Lincoln said, waving his hand over his nose.
Mendez ain't lying. He really needs a shower.
Fitz frowned.
Sorry, fellas, but command has another mission for us, he said. As soon as we get back to base, we're shipping out.
I'm going to be here for another night, Beckham said over the phone. Maybe more.
Maybe more? Kate asked. To her, that meant definitely more, but she had a feeling there was a good reason for the extended journey.
I'm really sorry, but there's a situation, Beckham said. President Ringgold has asked me and Horn to help monitor it.
I just want to remind you that you are retired.
I remember, Beckham said. This isn't field work.
A sinking feeling grew in her gut. She recalled that last conversation she and Beckham had shared, how they feared the quiet, the calm before the storm. Kate knew her husband probably couldn't share details, but she had to ask.
Is it really bad? She asked.
It isn't good, that's for sure. Beckham let out an audible exhalation. Don't tell anyone, okay?
Okay.
An outpost has gone completely dark and everyone there is missing.
Where?
Turkey River, in northern Iowa.
How does an entire outpost go?
I don't know, Kate, he said. I've got to go. But I love you, and will be home as soon as I can.
I love you, too, and remember what I said.
I'm retired. Got it. Kate said goodbye and let out a sigh.
She hated knowing that his instincts might be right, that something was going on out there beyond the walls and gates and sensors. All those technologies and measures they had relied on to protect the burgeoning communities around the Allied states had apparently failed outpost Turkey River. She prayed there was an explanation, and the people living there were okay. A knock on the door interrupted her thoughts. Javier beat her there and stood on his toes to look out the window in the door.
"It's Jake and Timothy," he said.
Kate nodded, giving Javier permission to let them in.
"Good evening," Jake said. "We come bearing tasty gifts."
Timothy raised an iced cake into the air at his father's goading.
"Wow," Kate said, reaching out. "Red velvet?"
"Sure is," Timothy replied, looking sheepish. The teenager was definitely a notch shyer than his father.
"Who told you that's my favorite?" she asked.
"Javier," Timothy replied.
Kate smiled and handed the cake to her son.
"Thank you so much for having us over for dinner," Jake said, stepping inside.
He bent down to unlace his boots, but Kate waved her hand.
"Keep them on."
"Were you sure?"
Jake asked, polite as usual.
"Of course. Come on in. It's so nice to have you two over."
"Thank you, doctor," Jake said.
"Kate," she reminded him.
"The table is set,"
Tasha called out.
"Sounds like you got some antsy guests," Jake said.
Kate chuckled.
Antsy doesn't begin to describe it.
She moved to the kitchen with Jake and Timothy tailing her. The smell of fresh marinara over spaghetti filled the air. One of Javier's favorites. Tasha and Jenny set the table while their dogs, Ginger and Spark, looked on from the connecting room. Tasha was old enough to be left home alone to watch Jenny, but Horn preferred they stayed here when he had to leave the island, and Kate suspected the girls preferred it too. The need to be around others was a psychological vestige of surviving war.
"Come get a plate,"
Kate said to Jake and the kids. Jenny and Javier raced over to be first in line. Timothy proved himself the gentleman, allowing Tasha to go first. Kate made a note to keep an eye on those two. Nearly the same age, she saw the looks they'd given each other and recalled her days as a carefree teenager.
"Looks really good," Tasha said as she began to fill her plate.
"Next time you're the chef," Kate said. Jenny groaned.
"Tasha can't cook. She's learning."
Kate looked to Tasha with an encouraging smile.
"I bet Tasha is a great chef," Timothy added.
Tasha's cheeks turned red.
"That was Dad on the phone, right?" Javier asked. "When does he get back tomorrow?"
Tasha and Jenny both looked up from their full plates.
"Dad and Parker aren't going to be home for another day or two," Kate informed them. "They have more business to take care of."
"Man," Tasha said.
"I know, but they will be home soon,"
Kate said, reaching across the table to place a hand on Tasha's.
"You know, your father's been invaluable when it comes to training the security detail," Jake said, looking at Javier and the girls in turn.
"How old do you have to be to join?" Javier asked.
Kate frowned, but wasn't caught off guard by the question.
"Much older than you, buddy," Jake said.
"About my age," Timothy said proudly.
He looked at Tasha to make sure she was listening.
"I'll be joining up soon."
Jenny tossed the dogs a piece of food from the table.
"I saw that," Kate said, not raising her eyes. "But Dad says," Jenny began to say. "His rules at his house, my rules at mine,"
Kate responded flatly.
"Okay, sorry,"
Jenny said, bowing her head slightly. Kate didn't like being harsh, but in a way she had become a second mom to the girls over the past decade since they lost their mother at Fort Bragg. Horn was a good dad, but there was no denying he carried with him a certain gruffness and wasn't a man of high formality. And Kate was intent on teaching the kids manners.
"This is really good," Tasha said, smiling as she went to take another bite.
"Sure is," Jenny agreed.
Javier nodded, his long hair falling over an eye. He brushed it away.
"My mom is the best cook.
Beats the pants off the potatoes and beans my dad makes," Timothy said.
Jake laughed.
"Never said I was a good cook."
A wild wind blew, and tree branches scraped against the house. Jenny's eyes went wide, and Tasha seemed to tense up at the sound of scratching branches on the window. Timothy reached for her hand. Kate could practically feel the temperature drop around the trio. They were frozen in fear. Those scratches along the roof, the wind rustling against the house, all could be mistaken for the telltale claws of variants on the hunt. 8 years, and still the teenagers were haunted by the memories of the slaughter and carnage they'd survived. Javier looked between them, one eyebrow raised like he didn't quite get why they were so scared. Unlike them, he had been born after the war. He'd been protected from the atrocities they'd borne witness to.
"It's okay," Kate said. "Just the wind." "I know."
Kate could tell the girl was starting to relax again.
"Every time, in my head, I tell myself that's all it is. But I can't help thinking that maybe this time it's different. Maybe this time it's a variant again."
"We're safe here," Kate said. "Don't worry."
"It's hard not to worry."
Jenny looked to Kate as she continued.
"They teach us about the war in school. I can't help thinking that it might happen again."
"I won't ever let anything happen to you kids," Jake added confidently.
"All I know is that if a variant does show up here, yeah, I'm gonna skin the ugly bastard," Javier said, gripping his fork and knife tightly like they were weapons. "Javier Riley, what did I tell you about that language? If Dad and Bighorn can cuss, why can't I?" Javier asked. "I'm gonna be a soldier like them, so I gotta act like one."
Kate looked hard at him, not giving the boy an inch. The boy was a warrior in the making, that much was sure. She supposed it was inevitable growing up in a household like his and surrounded by a community that had fought tooth and nail to establish itself, but that didn't mean she wanted that future for her son.
"You have a long time to figure out what you want to be."
A small smile played on Kate's lips.
"Maybe a scientist, or a doctor." "A soldier," Javier said firmly. "You have a long time to decide. Either way, no cussing, especially at the dinner table." "Fine, sorry."
She tried not to think about her son following in her husband's footsteps as they continued eating. Javier idolized his father in every way, even growing out his hair and insisting it be as long as his dad's. The boy finished another bite and added,
"I still want to protect people and kill the monsters."
"It's not just soldiers or policemen that protect us," Jake said. "Those doctors and scientists your mom mentioned are even more important. Heck, you can easily find another guy in the street that can learn to stand in a tower like me."
Jake tapped his temple.
"But if you've got half the smarts your mom does, you could grow up to be one amazing scientist who saves more lives than I could ever hope to with my rifle."
Kate smiled at the police officer. She appreciated the support in encouraging Javier to think of a different career. Of course, her own career as a scientist hadn't exactly been free from danger.
"So, what happened at school today?" Kate asked, changing the subject.
Timothy was studying the themes and ideas in 1984. Tasha and Jenny had both taken a math test, and Javier was reading The Boxcar Children, which Kate remembered fondly from her own childhood. Knowing they were all getting to have a childhood was a victory in everything they had fought to achieve, everything they had once taken for granted, and now had worked so hard to earn back. Peaceful moments like this, when no one was a soldier or scientist or survivor. They were just family and friends, enjoying life, not worrying about a monster hunting them or where their next meal would come from. It seemed almost like a joke when the distant call of an air raid siren blared, shattering any illusion that moments of peace were anything but ephemeral now. Spark jumped to his feet, and Ginger's tail curled between her legs.
"What is that?"
Javier asked, slowly standing. Timothy looked at his dad, who rose from the table. Tasha and Jenny, too, knew exactly what it was and were already grabbing the dogs to get them ready to move.
"Javier, get the bug-out bags," Kate said.
"I'm going back to my place to get ours," Jake said, grabbing a couple extra weapons, too.
Javier hurried out of the kitchen and ran to the bedroom while the officer left with Timothy. Kate went to the office and grabbed her Glock from the safe. Then she unlocked the cabinet and pulled out an AR-15 and a bag full of magazines. This was yet another harsh fact of reality. Emergency preparedness began as soon as Javier could walk. The community ran drills all the time, but those were always preceded with an announcement telling everyone it was just a drill. There had been no warning about the sirens, which told her it was either a surprise test or it was real. She wasn't taking any chances. Palming a magazine into the AR-15,
She then pulled the slide to chamber around and confirmed the safety was still on.
"Follow me," Kate said in her calmest voice.
The girls secured a leash around each dog's collar and took the shepherds to the front room. Javier was there with the bags.
"I got yours too, Mom," he said.
Kate put her bag over her back, doing her best to remain composed.
"Act normal, and the kids will follow your lead,"
she thought to herself.
"We need to get to the shelter," Kate said.
Javier slipped his hand into her free one and they walked out the front door, greeted by the wail of the air raid sirens. All along the street, their neighbors poured out of their houses and headed toward the shelter. Javier held out his free hand to Jenny. She took it and kept her other hand wrapped in Tasha's. Together, they hurried down the street, following the flow of the crowd. Familiar faces joined them along the way, like Donna and her son Beau, the mother and son that Beckham's team had rescued during the war. The boy had looked scraggly and weak when she'd first met him. Since then, he'd grown into a young man with linebacker shoulders and tree-trunk calves. Timothy and Jake ran to catch up, both armed with rifles and handguns. The duo ushered people toward the shelter.
"Jake, any idea what's going on?" Kate called out.
"Something about a blast in Portland," he replied.
"Good Lord," she said.
Kate pushed onward. The scenario felt all too familiar, hearkening back to those days when Beckham and Horn were off on some mission and disaster struck at home. Every time the variants or ROT had attacked, it felt like it could be the end of her time here on Earth. But this time, with the girls and Javier by her side, she felt they had so much more to lose. They continued down the road in an orderly fashion until the distant pop of gunfire shattered the night. Jenny shrieked, and Javier pulled on Kate's elbow, turning to look toward Portland, Maine. Another distant explosion bloomed into the night. The sight of the fireball chilled Kate to her core.
"Run!"
someone yelled. Screams came from all directions, and for the first time in years, the peace on Peaks Island was washed away like a sandcastle under the rising tide. 5. Voices chimed outside of Ringgold's office in the PEOC. Military officers conferred in trenchant whispers and gruff commands.
"Turkey River isn't the only outpost that has gone dark," said President Ringgold.
The tremor in her voice caught Beckham off guard almost as much as the news.
"Who else was hit?" Horn asked before Beckham could speak.
Ringgold tapped on one of the monitors on the conference room table, pointing at an old map of the United States.
"Outpost Rapid City, South Dakota just went offline, and we had almost zero communications before we lost contact."
"That's right on the border of the frontier with the West," Horn said.
Beckham narrowed his eyes at the president. This had to be some sort of a sick joke, or perhaps a glitch in communications. How could two outposts simply go dark? He thought of their families on Peaks Island. A tingle of worry threaded through his nerves. He simply didn't want to believe that these outposts going dark was because of something widespread. Something nefarious.
"We're not sure what's happening out there," Ringgold said.
She let out an uncharacteristic sigh, and then stiffened. Beckham watched her come back to life, seeming to summon the strength that had gotten through years of hardship, battles, and war.
"I'll meet you two in the Situation Room shortly," she said. "I need to make some calls."
Beckham and Horn both filed into the small conference room in the PEOC. Of all the places in the world, Beckham never thought he would end up in the Situation Room again. The white walls were covered with the pictures of former presidents and a large American flag. This place was normally occupied by four-star generals, the Joint Chiefs, POTUS, V-POTUS, the NSA advisor, and the executive cabinet. Now it was close to empty. Brigadier General Lucas Barnes was hunched over a laptop near the head of the table, squinting at the screen, his glasses propped up in his gray hair. He glanced up with dark brown eyes that matched the color of his skin and nodded at Beckham. The 60-year-old general was overseeing the mission to Outpost Turkey River and was in constant communication with General Noah Souza, the commander of the Special Operations Command, SOCOM. Beckham recalled the day they had moved SOCOM from MacDill Air Force Base to the Zumwalt-class destroyer launched shortly before the hemorrhage virus ravaged the world. It had been recommissioned as the USS George Johnson to honor the vice president that was killed not far from where they all sat right now.
Across from the Brigadier General was National Security Advisor Ben Nelson, wearing his staple red tie. He ruffled through a briefing. Vice President Dan Lemke sat at the opposite end with his Chief of Staff, Elizabeth Cortez, behind him. Ringgold's Chief of Staff, James Soprano, rested his back against a wall, gripping a folder under his arms.
"Looks like you've been hitting the gym," Beckham said to ease the tension.
Soprano smiled.
"When you've got a free personal trainer who doesn't let you skip a day, these things happen," he said, jerking his chin at Cortez.
Her face broke into a grin. "You skip plenty of days." Cortez gestured to two of the empty seats where name tags had been set out for Beckham and Horn. They sat in their respective seats. Cortez continued to stand, glancing occasionally at the door. Even as she stood, she continued tapping her right foot against the floor. The door opened, and President Ringgold stepped in, prompting General Barnes to stand and offer her his chair in front of the laptop.
"That's okay. You sit, General," she said politely. "I'll take my usual spot."
Ringgold sat next to Lemke. Soprano handed her a folder before retreating back to his spot at the wall.
"What's our status?" Ringgold asked.
"We have SEAL Teams 2 and 3 deployed in Operation Snake, with Delta Force Team Ghost on standby," Barnes said in his gruff voice. "Ghost just tracked down and killed an Alpha at Ellicott City. Saved a prisoner, too."
"That's our boy Fitz," Horn said.
Beckham had a feeling Ghost wasn't going to get much downtime to celebrate the small victory. The SEAL teams were both filled with talented men, but many of them were new and lacked the experience that Fitz and his team had under their belts. He wouldn't be surprised if Ghost was called off standby and deployed in the operation.
"Turkey River went offline approximately 21 hours ago, and so far drone footage has not given us much to go by," Barnes continued. "SEAL Team 2 will land in approximately 10 minutes, but SEAL Team 3 will take approximately 1 hour to reach Outpost Rapid City."
"And the emergency alert system?" Ringgold asked.
"Activated as soon as we got word about Rapid City," said Nelson. "Every outpost and city in the safe zones will be on lockdown until we figure out what's going on." Beckham thought of his family back at the outpost in Portland. He wished he had the chance to tell Kate this was coming so it didn't scare Javier or Tasha and Jenny.
"Bringing up footage from SEAL Team 2, Barnes said.
He pushed his headset back into position, talking to General Souza. The wall-mounted monitor fired to life, splitting into a dozen boxes from the helmet-mounted cams of the SEALs.
"Here we go,"
Barnes said.
"SEAL Team 2 is 1 minute out from the LZ."
"Do we have any new drone footage?" Lemke asked.
He flipped through his briefing folder.
"These images make it seem like the entire outpost just vanished. 300 people don't just..."
304, Ringgold corrected.
"Yes, that's correct," Barnes said. 304 people don't just vanish."
The Black Hawk carrying SEAL Team 2 crossed over a patchwork of crops and lowered into the compound. The pilots sat down in an open area, disgorging the SEALs into the darkness of the night. Their cameras with night vision optics provided a green-hued view of the agricultural community as the team split up to search for the residents. Beckham scanned the screens one by one, looking for any sign of bodies or blood or a battle, anything to indicate what had happened. But all he saw were empty buildings: a school, the post office, 2 trading posts, the barracks and offices. All empty. Another team moved to the barns and livestock pens located just outside the walls of the main compound. A series of ribbon wire fences looked intact, but several of the SEALs stopped at the edge to look through the chain links.
"We got something," Barnes reported, looking up.
He put a palm over his headset to listen. Beckham strained to see, but there was definitely something on the other side of the fences. Several craters dotted the terrain from what must have been exploded landmines.
"They found the remains of several soldiers, Madam President," Barnes reported. "They're on screen 7.
Beckham was already looking at that screen. The SEAL directed his helmet cam at a crater, roving it back and forth before stopping on what looked a lot like mangled human limbs and a torso. "The militia soldiers there got caught in the minefields, but not variants?" Nelson asked.
"Actually, the SEALs think the variants tossed the soldiers in the minefields," Lemke said. "There were claw marks on the corpses, and tracks indicating such."
"Something doesn't add up here," Nelson said. "The beasts aren't normally that smart." "Have the other SEALs found anything else?" Ringgold asked.
Negative, Madam President, Barnes said. Not a single body.
What about the livestock? Beckham asked. Barnes asked over the comms and came back with an answer a moment later.
Gone, he said. No bodies, no bones.
Beckham used his prosthetic hand to brush the hair back into place on his head, his new nervous tic. Something about it calmed him and helped him think, but it didn't help him make sense of what he was seeing on the screens.
The variants took all of them without even stopping for a snack? Nelson asked.
I've rarely heard of monsters with that kind of self-control.
You're right,
Horn said, speaking up for the first time.
Normal variants wouldn't do this.
We must be looking at some kind of twisted alpha, Beckham said. Maybe even something else leading them, keeping them under control.
And there's only one team that can track down whatever or whoever is responsible, Horn said.
He glanced at Beckham, who agreed with his friend.
If SEAL Team 2 doesn't come back with anything else, I'd highly recommend deploying Team Ghost, Beckham said. They have experience with all kinds of alphas. If anyone can get to the bottom of this, it's them.
Barnes looked to the president for her approval, and she gave it with a nod. She got up from her chair and walked over to the screen as SEAL Team 2 continued the search.
Yes,
Barnes said into his headset. His features suddenly darkened, and he squinted so hard his forehead turned into a valley of wrinkles.
What? Another one, he said.
Ringgold turned to look at the general. What's wrong? She asked. Barnes swallowed, his Adam's apple bobbing.
Madam President, General Souza just got word that Outpost New Boston in Massachusetts is reporting a raider attack.
He paused and put his hand over his headset again to listen.
Christ, Barnes grumbled. Outpost Portland, Maine is also under attack.
Beckham's veins turned to ice. He shot out of his chair.
What? How is that possible?
Images of Kate and the children slammed through his mind.
We have to get home,
Horn said, already moving toward the door. Beckham turned to follow Horn, then stopped. A dozen thoughts spun through his mind. He wanted to believe that people like his neighbor Jake could defend the island and that the safe zone's defenses were prepared for something like this. But between the images they'd just seen of Outpost Turkey River and the reports coming in from other outposts, reality was much more grim. He couldn't help but think these events were connected. Were they dealing with a massive coordinated variant and human threat for the first time since the end of the war? Beckham hesitated. He needed to know more before bailing.
Boss, come on,
Horn urged.
Hold up, Beckham shot back.
He looked to Barnes.
What does General Souza know so far about Portland?
Only that they called in an SOS sparked by a raid, replied the general. Reed, we can't stay here.
The muscles in Horn's jaw moved as he gritted his teeth.
Gotta get back there, man.
Permission to leave, Madam President, Beckham said. Get a chopper fired up, Ringgold said to Soprano. The COS rushed through the door, already conveying the president's order to someone outside the situation room. Beckham and Horn followed her out, Ringgold shadowing them. She stopped just outside. The pain in her features told Beckham she felt partly responsible for this. But this wasn't her fault. She had done everything she could to rebuild and protect the country, and Beckham couldn't sit idly by any longer in retirement on an island away from the fight. It was time to get back into the game.
If it's not already too late, he thought coldly.
The custom blue jet circled over S.M. Fisher's ranch and the oil fields in northern Texas, about 90 miles north of Amarillo. Fisher Fields, his business and his empire. This was home. Always had been, always would be. Passed down through his family back during the pre-war days, it had reached values in the hundreds of millions of dollars. His wife had loved it here. She had always dreamed of the day he would retire, enjoying riding horses together along the creeks and trails cutting through their property, and ending the days on their porch enjoying the glory of a Texas sunset. But it was not to be. She had passed from cancer 2 months before the hemorrhage virus. Now it looked like Fisher would never retire. While he missed her, he was almost glad it had happened before the chaos. If she had survived any longer, she would have risked being torn to pieces or turned into one of those beasts. To Fisher, that was a far worse fate. Her death to cancer hadn't exactly been peaceful, but at least he had been there holding her hand while she passed in her sleep. God, did he miss her. He drowned out the memories by finishing his third beer while the pilots waited for the yaw clear to land. Another variant attack had kept them in the sky, and Fisher was anxious to get on the ground. At 10,000 feet, he couldn't see much of his 40,000 acres of land, especially at night. But in the blanket of darkness below, several geysers of orange flames punctuated the black, spewing columns of smoke that reflected the light of the fire. Fisher's gut twisted painfully. He was no stranger to a hellish sight like that.
Oil well fires! What in the Sam hell is happening down there? Fisher asked.
The two bodyguards that had accompanied him to the Greenbrier sat in leather chairs across the cabin. Tran and Chase had both been with Fisher since the war and had never failed in protecting him. Chase disappeared into the cockpit for a moment, then reemerged.
Sounds like there have been variant attacks on multiple wells. They went after the engineers again, and our teams are having a hard time capping the wells.
Second time in a month, Fisher said, finishing his comment with a blue streak of curses.
He tried to be a gentleman in most cases, but damn, this was pissing him off. Using a bottle opener, he twisted off the cap of another beer, wishing it was the head of a variant. He took a long swig and studied the bottle, another product made at his ranch just like the juicy hunk of steak in front of him. This hadn't been the first attack on his ranch, and he knew better than to think it would be the last. The variants were getting more brazen in their efforts. He was getting tired of losing men, and more importantly, money. Tipping back the bottle, he took another long swig, and then put the bottle down. He caught Tran giving Chase a knowing look. They were right. He should have his senses together. Three beers gave him a buzz, but anything more could be a detriment to decision-making. He looked to Chase and said,
"Tell the pilots I want on the ground as soon as fucking possible."
The thin African-American man stood again and made his way back into the cockpit. Tran swiveled his leather chair to look out the window.
"These attacks have to end," Fisher grumbled. "We're wasting time capping oil wells when we should be drawing oil up. These filthy, diseased animals are costing us too damn much."
Tran turned away from the window to face his boss.
"I thought President Ringgold was going to send more boots to protect the fields."
"She did. But I don't need 24 greenhorns."
Fisher took another swallow of his beer. He knew he shouldn't, but he was too damn mad.
"I need an army to clean the varmints out once and for all. Perhaps General Cornelius will make me an offer I can't refuse."
Tran simply nodded, and Fisher considered asking him his opinion. Most men in his position wouldn't bother listening to hired muscle or soldiers, but Fisher had built his empire by analyzing the opinions of many, from the engineers that worked on the wells to the president of the country. So far, those opinions weren't helping much.
"Who do you support?" Fisher asked.
Tran shifted uneasily in his chair, apparently caught off guard by the sudden change in topic. Fisher had seen him less nervous when facing variants.
"It's okay, son, you can talk to me freely," Fisher assured Tran.
"I don't support nuking the city, sir. But I do support eliminating the variant threat, especially down there. These attacks are growing more brazen, and I fear the creatures are starting to get stronger instead of weaker."
"Valid assessment," Fisher said.
He looked back down at his steak. It was getting cold, and he wasn't going to waste a good sirloin. Meat of this quality was a luxury that only a few men in this country could afford. While the plane continued to circle, he cut into the seared meat. The red inside practically bled. He took a bite of the rare steak and relished the taste like the variants might savor the taste of human flesh. Chase returned from the cockpit.
"So we need to wait a few more minutes for teams to secure the tarmac for our landing," he reported. "Apparently one of those variant packs is near your ranch."
"What's so damn hard about clearing out two little packs?" Fisher said.
"They're both camouflaged," Chase replied. "Our teams are finding it more difficult than usual to track them down. We've deployed dogs and hunter-killer teams, though. Shouldn't be much longer."
Fisher put down his fork, his appetite ruined.
He wiped food off his bristly mustache with a napkin and prepared for landing. 10 minutes later, they had the all clear, and the jet began its descent. Fisher looked out his window to search for the flames he saw earlier. Sure enough, the well fires still burned, the deep stores of oil being lapped up by tongues of fire. The flames might as well have been burning dollar bills. But how could a variant start a fire? They had attacked the wells plenty of times, but the wells had never burned like this. Not two at once. He doubted common variants had the smarts for starting fires like that. Maybe his men had really screwed the pooch on this one. Or maybe it was something else. As the jet lowered toward the tarmac, Fisher thought of his meeting with President Ringgold. She had promised him more men to patrol the oil fields, but a handful more of guards wasn't going to stop the beasts. When your cattle were being stalked by a pack of wolves, it wasn't enough to wait around at night in hopes you might scare them from dragging a cow away. No, you went straight to the source, straight to the wolf's den. You slaughtered every one of them so not a damn one of those dogs came back to bother you or your cattle. What he needed was an army of hunters, someone who could be on the offense instead of pressed against the ropes the whole time. This had to end. The tires touched down with a jolt. As they slowed, Tran and Chase both unbuckled and moved to the cabinets to grab their rifles. They palmed in magazines, pulled back the bolts to chamber around, and then advanced to the door. One of the pilots stepped out of the cabin. "Sir, your teams have taken down one pack and captured what we think is an Alpha," he said. Just as Fisher thought. More than just common variants. "It's alive, sir, but barely," the pilot continued. "Bring it to the tarmac," Fisher said. "I want to see this ugly sumbitch that's been terrorizing my fields." "Sir, I'd highly advise against that," Chase replied. "This is an Alpha," Tran reminded Fisher. "They're extremely dangerous even when injured." "I know what it is," Fisher shot back. "I want to see it, and I want to finish it off myself." "Okay, sir," Tran said with a shrug. "But please stay here until we can secure the area." Chase opened the cabin door and walked down a ramp to the tarmac. Tran remained in the opening, rifle shouldered. Fisher pulled out his handgun, his father's old chrome 357. He'd added a new engraving to the barrel. "Monster killer." Maybe it was a little corny, but Fisher wasn't one to mince words. Monster killer was what the weapon was, and killing a monster was what he was about to do. Pulling back the hammer with a click, he prepared to meet the beast terrorizing his men and fields tonight. Not some pesky, diseased beast, but the king of the pack. A few minutes later, Chase returned with his rifle cradled. "Okay, sir, it's safe to come out." Fisher followed his men down the ramp. Several Humvees and multiple pickup trucks were parked on the tarmac with the red double F logo of his oil company. Soldiers in the mounted gun turrets of the Humvees directed spotlights on the pale, bloody flesh of the biggest variant Fisher had ever seen. The creature was lying inside a razor wire net, hardly moving. A dozen men wearing cowboy hats and holding rifles stood guarding the beast. Six German shepherds barked viciously, their maws dripping saliva. "Shut them up," Fisher ordered. He hesitated as he approached the monster. The beast was unconscious from what he could tell, both eyelids closed.
"It took a lot of damage before passing out," one of the soldiers said. "Big guy like this, we thought you'd want to see what was responsible for the mess out there. Surprised it's not dead yet."
"But no telling when it's going to wake up," another said.
"It killed four of our men," the first man added.
He dipped his cowboy hat at Fisher and spat a hunk of tobacco on the pavement.
"Quicker you kill it, the better, sir."
Fisher walked past the man, doing his best to hide his fear of the monster. Chase and Tran both kept near his side with their rifles aimed at the Alpha.
"Don't get too close," Tran warned.
Fisher stopped 5 feet away from the naked creature. A wart-covered nose sucked in air, and a scab-covered back rose up and down in long, deep breaths. Crackling came from the lungs as fluid filled them. He took another step closer, watching the eyes to make sure they didn't open. Then he bent down to study the demon. Wormy lips hung off a chin that was only connected to the face by strands of gristle.
Blood flowed out of small holes in the upper cheek from shotgun pellets.
My lord in heaven,
Fisher muttered. He stood and moved around to check the other injuries. A muscular arm was shredded at the elbow, and a hole the size of an orange gushed blood out of its back. Bullet holes pocked the creature's torso, blood seeping out. Fisher knew that the Alpha, like all variants, had remarkable healing capabilities due to the epigenetic changes of the chemical nanoparticles in its bloodstream, but it would take a lot to come back from these injuries, and Fisher wasn't going to give it a chance. He aimed his .357 at the beast's head. An eyelid flicked open, a reptilian eye flitting toward Fisher. He stumbled backward as its upper lip drew back to reveal jagged yellow teeth. The shredded chin and jaw hung loose, a strand of gristle snapping as it opened its mouth wider.
"Kill it,"
Chase said. Fisher pulled the trigger, the gunshot piercing the night. The round broke through bone right below the yellow eye. But the creature didn't die. A screech of rage followed, piercing Fisher's ears. He glared at the monster in shock as blood burst from the hole in its face. The Alpha roared and twisted violently under the razor wire, opening up cuts across its entire body and prompting all of the men with rifles to step back. The dogs let out guttural barks.
"Jesus Christ," Fisher said.
He aimed, held the gun steady, and fired a bullet into the eye. It popped, exploding and leaking blood and goo. Still, the beast continued to screech.
"Shoot it,"
Fisher said, gesturing to the soldiers and other men around him.
"Open fire!"
A hail of gunfire lanced into the monster, punching through muscular flesh and bone. The monster jerked and twitched in violent fits as the rounds pummeled its body. Fisher finally held up a hand.
"Hold your fire!"
he yelled. The men lowered their rifles, but the dogs continued to go crazy, barking and pulling on their leashes. The creature let out a final, gruesome death rattle, and then went limp, blood pooling from its lacerated flesh. Although Fisher wanted to think this was the last of his variant problems, he knew it wasn't. Kill one pack of wolves, another took their place. There would be more beasts, more alphas. Only one thing would end the threat.
"Get that thing out of here," Fisher ordered.
He holstered his gun and jerked his chin for Tran and Chase to follow him over to a vehicle to take him to his ranch. He took shotgun and shut the door, watching as his men dragged the monster off the tarmac. It took 10 of them to get it into the back of a pickup truck. This wasn't going to stop, not with this dead Alpha, and not with the next one either. Fisher Fields needed an army, and Fisher had a feeling there was only one person that could give him the resources he needed. He rode home in silence, thinking of his upcoming meeting with Cornelius. He was more anxious than ever to hear what the presidential candidate had to offer in return for his support. 6. Approaching LZ, reported the pilot. Fitz tried to stay focused, looking out the open side door of the Blackhawk as they circled over outpost Turkey River. A full moon hung like a gleaming silver disc over the darkened fields. Cloud cover to the west threatened to block out the glow. The entire team was already on